Hello everyone! Before we begin this episode, I would like to make a special announcement that The Trail Went Cold will be partnering this month with Season of Justice, a non-profit organization dedicated to helping families shed new light on their cold cases and helping investigative agencies bridge the funding gap, preventing them from accessing cutting-edge forensic technology. Season of Justice is a connecting thread between advocacy and support for families and investigative agencies around the world, and will give you the power to have a direct and meaningful impact on something you are passionate about. So for the month of February, we would like to invite you, the listeners, to join us in a special campaign in support of Season of Justice, which works directly with families to fund comprehensive awareness campaigns in hopes of bringing a resolution to unsolved cases. They provide grants to investigative agencies that fund DNA testing and forensic genetic genealogy research to solve cold cases. Since 2020, Season of Justice has raised more than $1 million in grants for more than 140 cold cases in North America, and six of them have wound up being solved. As an example of their efforts, they raised money for a billboard about the unsolved murder of Leon Laurelis, which I covered on episode number 297 of this podcast. But Season of Justice can't do this alone, which is why we're asking you to consider donating this month. If you are able to make a donation to Season of Justice that is meaningful to you, you'll be helping victims' families find answers. You can join us today in supporting Season of Justice with a donation by visiting givebutter.com/SOJ_the trail or by texting trail24 to 53555. You'll also find links and information about this in our show notes and on our social media pages. Our campaign with Season of Justice will be lasting the entire month of February, and there will be more reminders on our upcoming episodes. So thank you very much for your support, and enjoy today's episode. February 2nd, 2008. Tinley Park, Illinois. Police are summoned to a Lane Bryant clothing store at the Brookside Marketplace Shopping Center and discover that five victims have been fatally shot in the back room. 42-year-old Rhoda McFarland, 37-year-old Connie Wolfolk, 34-year-old Jennifer Bishop, 33-year-old Carrie Hudak Chuso, and 22-year-old Sarah Safransky. Even though another store employee was wounded with a bullet which grazed her neck, she winds up surviving and tells police that the shooting was committed by a black man. While the crime is suspected to be a robbery gone wrong, investigators are unable to find or identify the perpetrator, so the Lane Bryant shooting remains unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a mass murder in which there were numerous victims. The 2008 deaths of Rhoda McFarland, Connie Wolfolk, Jennifer Bishop, Carrie Hudak Chuso, and Sarah Safransky, aka the Lane Bryant shooting. That audio you just heard was a snippet of a 911 call one of the victims made right before she was shot, and we'll be discussing it in more detail later on. Ever since the inception of this podcast, I've received a ton of requests to cover this case, and given that the 16-year anniversary of this crime takes place 2 days after this episode's release, I thought now would be a good time to finally tackle it. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that mass shootings in public places have become one of the biggest problems in the United States, but you're not going to find too many mass shootings which are unsolved and where the perpetrator has managed to get away with it for an extended period of time. In fact, if you were to put together a list of cases featured on The Trail Went Cold that you would not expect to still be unsolved, this would probably rank right near the very top. This is the horrific story of an unidentified man who entered a Lane Bryant clothing outlet during business hours and proceeded to commit a robbery and shoot six people. Four of the victims were customers, one of them was the store manager, and the last victim was an employee who managed to survive. After the survivor provided a detailed description of the shooter, a massive manhunt was performed for him, but he could not be tracked down or identified. While it's been theorized that the crime was a robbery gone wrong, there are so many things about the perpetrator's actions which just do not make much sense. For instance, after he restrained the victims in the back room, he proceeded to hang around the store for nearly 40 minutes and only decided to shoot everyone when the manager called 911. This has led to speculation that there may have been another motive for this crime besides simple robbery, but the authorities have been unable to figure it out, so we're going to explore all the potential theories on this episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content, as our Patreon page currently has nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve in to the Lane Bryant shooting. Our story begins in 2008 in Tinley Park, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago located in both Cook County and Will County, which has a population of around 55,000. In fact, the year after this crime took place, Business Week magazine would name Tinley Park as the best place in America to raise a family, which is quite ironic given the circumstances. At 10:44 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, February the 2nd, the Will County Sheriff's Office received a 911 call from a woman who said she was calling for help from a Lane Bryant outlet in Tinley Park. Since the Tinley Park Police Department had jurisdiction over the area, the call was transferred to them. In case you're not familiar with the brand, Lane Bryant Incorporated is the largest retailer of plus-size clothing for women in the United States, and this particular store was at a suburban strip mall called the Brookside Marketplace Shopping Center, located on Harlem Avenue just off Interstate 80. At the time the 911 call came in, a Tinley Park police officer just happened to be in the parking lot of a Target store in the same strip mall a few hundred yards away, so he immediately responded to the call and was able to make it over to the Lane Bryant within 2 minutes. When the officer went inside, the store appeared to be empty, but he soon went into the back room and discovered that six women were lying on the floor. They'd each been bound with duct tape and had underwear placed over their heads before they were shot execution style. One of the victims was the 42-year-old store manager, Rhoda McFarland, who had made the 911 call. While the other victims were shot through the back of their heads, Rhoda was shot through the front. Rhoda lived nearly 20 miles away in Joliet, and while she had one divorce under her belt, she had recently gotten engaged to her fiancé and was planning to get remarried. After having previously served in the Air Force and worked as an associate pastor, Rhoda decided to change the course of her life around the time she reached her 40s. When she was originally hired at the Lane Bryant store, the job was only meant to be temporary, but Rhoda realized that she liked working in retail and was soon promoted to manager. At this particular point, Rhoda had been employed there for 2 years and was very well liked by the store's customers and staff, and she would often use her employee discount to purchase clothing and donate it to the less fortunate. In a tragic turn of events, Rhoda had not originally been scheduled to work on the morning of the shooting, but since another employee couldn't make it and there was a clearance sale taking place, Rhoda decided to come in to help out. The other four deceased victims were customers who just happened to be frequenting the store when the crime took place. One of them was 37-year-old Connie Wolfolk, a single mother who lived 8 miles away in the village of Flossmoor and worked hard to provide for her 2 sons, the youngest of whom suffered from spina bifida. While Connie worked as a mortgage lender and was planning to start her own mortgage company with her mother, she currently had to take on a second job working the overnight shift at the same Target store located near the Lane Bryant. On this particular day, she had plans to go out with friends and presumably stop by the Lane Bryant in order to pick out a new outfit. Unlike the other victims, Connie had a bloody and bruised face, as she had apparently made an attempt to fight back against her killer, who likely responded by pistol-whipping her with their gun. Our next victim was 33-year-old Carrie Hudek Chuso, who lived nearly 9 miles away in the village of Frankfurt and worked as a social worker for at-risk youth at Homewood Flossmoor High School. She had been married for 2 years at this point and was planning to have children with her husband. Like Connie, Carrie was planning a get-together with friends later that evening and stopped by the Lane Bryant store to purchase a new outfit. The youngest victim, 22-year-old Sarah Zavransky, lived about 5 miles away in Oak Forest and had graduated from Northern Illinois University the previous spring. Sarah now had a job lined up at the CNA Financial Corporation and stopped by Lane Bryant in order to purchase some new work clothes. The last deceased victim was 34-year-old Jennifer Bishop, who actually lived across the state line in South Bend, Indiana, over 85 miles away. Jennifer was married and had 3 young children, including a 6-month-old boy, and worked as an intensive care nurse. She had traveled to Tinley Park for the weekend with her husband because he had a work convention there, and it's believed that Jennifer stopped by the store because a family member had given her a Lane Bryant gift card for her birthday only 5 days earlier. It's also worth mentioning that the races of the victims varied, as Rhoda and Connie were black, while Carrie, Sarah, and Jennifer were white. While these 5 women were pronounced dead at the scene, the 6th woman found lying on the floor in the back room was still alive. It seemed apparent that the killer had fired a shot towards the back of her head, but the bullet only grazed and wounded the left side of her neck. The survivor would later say that she turned her head at the very last second when the shot was fired and reacted by playing dead until the shooter left the scene. This woman was an employee at the store, but in order to protect her privacy, the authorities have never released her name to the public. During the earliest coverage of this case, the media referred to her by the pseudonym Martha, so that's what I'll call her for the rest of this episode. It was revealed that Martha was a 33-year-old nursing student who worked part-time at Lane Bryant on the weekends, and she and Rhoda had opened the store together at 10 a.m. that morning. After Martha's neck wound was treated at the scene, she spent the night at a local hospital before the authorities placed her in protective custody. Martha told police that only 1 perpetrator was responsible for the crime, and described him as being a clean-shaven black male with a medium complexion, who appeared to be between 25 and 35 years old, and had thick, cornrowed hair and a receding hairline. She also said that one of the braids in his hair was dangling over his right cheek and decorated with 4 light green beads on the end. The man was approximately 5'9" or 6 feet tall and weighed between 200 and 300 pounds and had broad shoulders. Martha said that he was dressed in a dark-colored winter coat and black jeans with rhinestones on the back pocket, which resembled a cursive G, and he wore a dark gray skullcap. According to Martha, the man arrived at the store only a few minutes after it opened and told Rhoda that he was supposed to make a delivery. There were no deliveries scheduled that day, but after Rhoda chatted with the man for a few minutes, she offered to call some other Lane Bryant outlets in the area to check if he was supposed to deliver something there instead. Well, the man suddenly pulled out a gun and demanded that Rhoda give him all the money in the register. In addition to Rhoda and Martha, there were 2 customers in the store at this time, though it's never been publicly revealed which of the 2 customers they were. But the gunman demanded that each woman hand over all the cash they had on them, as well as any jewelry they were wearing. It's unclear how much money he got in total, but it's believed that the store's register only contained about $200 in cash, as the majority of the purchases there were made via debit or credit card. The gunman then forced the 4 women into the back room, where he ordered them to lie face down on the floor, before he proceeded to bind their hands with some duct tape he had brought with him. He also took some pieces of underwear from a display and placed them on top of each woman's head, possibly in an attempt to obstruct their vision. It's been reported that the gunman fondled one of the women, though it's never been revealed which one. While this was going on, the two other female customers gradually walked into the store, but were immediately intercepted by the gunman, who forced them to join the others on the floor in the back room before he bound them with duct tape. Once again, it's not clear which customers came into the store at what time, but I'm guessing that Connie Wolfhook was one of the last two customers to enter, as she seemingly fought back against the gunman, which prompted him to strike her in the face. For reasons unknown, this guy remained with the victims inside the store for nearly 40 minutes, and according to Martha, he became increasingly more agitated. Since Rhoda was wearing a Bluetooth headset, she was able to use her cell phone to secretly call 911. At the beginning of this episode, I played some audio from the call, where Rhoda could be heard whispering the words, quote, "I'm in Lane Bryant." When the 911 dispatcher asked where the store was located, Rhoda whispered, quote, "Tinley Park, hurry," and the dispatcher urged her to stay on the line while she sent help. Now, the full audio of this 911 call has never been released publicly, but a few months after the crime took place, investigators decided to release a longer version of the call with enhanced audio, in which you could hear the gunman's voice in the background. Most of what he's saying is unintelligible, but at one point, it sounds like you can hear him utter the words, quote, "I'm losing it." Here's that version of the audio, which has been released.
911 emergency.
Since the volume was turned up on Rhoda's phone, it appears that the gunman may have heard the dispatcher's voice and realized that she called 911. Immediately after the call ended, he fired shots into Rhoda and all the other victims before fleeing the scene, and even though the first police officer arrived only 2 minutes later, the gunman was already gone. Following the discovery of the victims' bodies, the Brookside Marketplace Shopping Center was closed and placed on lockdown while law enforcement searched for the shooter. At one point, they detained a black man named Sean Tyus, who was sitting inside his car in the parking lot of the nearby Target store. However, Tyus did not have any braids in his hair like Martha had described and was not carrying a gun. It turned out he had driven his girlfriend to Target and did not arrive until after the shooting took place, so Tyus was cleared as a suspect. Even though a massive manhunt was performed throughout Tinley Park and the surrounding area, the authorities had no success at finding the perpetrator. But since the shopping center was located just off Interstate 80, there was fear that he may have used it to immediately flee the area before the manhunt got started. Based off Martha's description, a composite sketch of the suspect was created and circulated by the media, but even though this led to a number of tips, he could not be positively identified. The most unique detail shared about the gunman was the braid dangling over his right cheek with four light green beads on the end. Investigators visited a number of local salons to see if anyone recalled braiding the hair of any men matching the suspect's description, but this lead came up empty. In response to the tragedy, Lane Bryant Incorporated closed their outlet at the Brookside Marketplace Shopping Center and donated all the remaining clothing items to local charities. They also announced the establishment of the Lane Bryant Tinley Park Memorial Fund, which would honor the five deceased victims and provide their families with financial assistance. In addition, Lane Bryant's parent company, Charming Shops, contributed $50,000 to a reward, which wound up totaling $100,000. What's unique about this reward is that it will be paid out for information which leads to the arrest of a suspect, but unlike many other cold cases, the payout is not contingent on the suspect being convicted of the crime. In spite of this, the reward has not yet paved the way for any information which has led to the shooter's identification. Unfortunately, the Lane Bryant store did not have any security cameras which captured an image of the shooter, so investigators checked surveillance footage from other locations at the shopping center. They were unable to uncover any footage of the suspects, but a security camera from the nearby Target store did provide a potentially intriguing lead. Since the footage was shot from hundreds of yards away, it was incredibly blurry, But after this case was featured on an episode of America's Most Wanted, the show agreed to provide the necessary funding for the Tinley Park Police Department to send the footage to NASA. After NASA enhanced the footage as best they could, investigators were able to make out a dark sedan and a larger SUV-type vehicle pulling up near the Lane Bryant store at 10:39 and 10:40 a.m., respectively. Of course, this was only a few minutes before Rhoda's 911 call took place, and both vehicles wound up driving away just 1 minute later at 10:45. While there was no footage of the gunman exiting the store and climbing into either of the vehicles, the timing caused investigators to speculate that someone may have functioned as a getaway driver, meaning that multiple people were involved in the crime. And even if neither of the vehicles were connected to the shooting, the authorities still wanted to track down the drivers and question them as potential witnesses in case they saw something important. Investigators looked into the backgrounds of all six victims, but saw nothing to indicate that any of them had serious enemies who would have had the motive to murder them in a public place. There was one interesting angle involving Rhoda McFarland's background, but I'll talk more about that later on. A criminal profile was created for the shooter, where it was theorized that he had previously spent time in prison and was so desperate not to go back that he was willing to murder six women if there was any chance they could identify him. It has also been speculated that he may have gotten into additional trouble with the law in the years following the murders and might be incarcerated somewhere today for another crime. Based on the bullets and shell casings found at the scene, it was determined that the murder weapon was a .40 caliber semi-automatic Glock handgun, but in spite of an extensive search, the gun has never been recovered. There's also been a lot of uncertainty about whether or not the killer left any forensic evidence behind at the scene. Over the years, a few media sources have reported that DNA was collected, but in an 8-year anniversary article about the crime published in the Chicago Tribune in February of 2016, the lead investigator at that time, Tinley Park Detective Ray Violetto, stated that a quote-unquote very large amount of evidence was taken from the scene and sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab for examination. Violetto said that while the majority of the evidence was studied, they, quote-unquote, did not receive the results we hoped we would for one particularly crucial piece of evidence. Violetto also confirmed that investigators have never discussed any specific evidence that was recovered, such as fingerprints or DNA. Obviously, a complicating factor is that since this crime took place inside a public place of business, it might be hard to distinguish which forensic evidence is from the killer and what evidence simply belongs to random customers who frequented the store on a previous occasion. There's been unconfirmed speculation that blood was found under Connie Wolfolk's fingernails, which might have been drawn from the shooter when she attempted to fight him off. But even if that is true, any DNA samples which might have been drawn from his blood have obviously never been matched to anyone. After the Lane Bryant outlet closed down, the building remained unoccupied for nearly 6 years until another clothing retail chain, TJ Maxx, decided to open a store there in November of 2013. In February of 2018, on the 10-year anniversary of the crime, investigators released a new 3D image of the gunman's composite sketch, but it still did not lead to him being identified. We are now closing in on the crime's 16-year anniversary, but unfortunately, the identity of the killer and his motives are still unknown, and the Lane Bryant shooting continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this case has often been referred to as one of the few unsolved mass shootings in the United States, but I think what separates this shooting from most of the others is that the perpetrator may not have originally planned on killing anyone. Many mass shooters only care about attaining notoriety and don't have any pretense that they're going to get away with it, so once they've completed their crime, they will often kill themselves or allow themselves to be killed or captured by law enforcement. But here, The perpetrator may have only planned on committing a robbery and wound up shooting six people because he lost control of the situation and something went horribly wrong. Regardless of the shooter's intent, this seemed like a very sloppy and disorganized crime, and since he left behind a surviving victim and the case wound up generating a ton of publicity, it seems astonishing that the responsible party has managed to get away with it and remain unidentified for 16 years. Another thing which makes this cold case stand out from many others is that we have a witness, known only as Martha, who was able to provide a step-by-step account of how this crime was carried out, but her account only raises more questions than answers since the actions of the perpetrator do not make a lot of sense. This is obviously not the only unsolved case we've covered on The Trail Went Cold, where multiple victims have been murdered in a public workplace, with other examples being the Austin Yogurt Shop murders, the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre, and the Florence Salon murders. Each of these cases have their own baffling elements, but none of them feature the perpetrator hanging around the scene for nearly 40 minutes during business hours. Yes, I suppose the killers in the Austin Yogurt Shop murders remained there for a lengthy period of time, but at least they did it late at night after the shop closed. That's a far cry from doing something like that in broad daylight on a Saturday morning, while additional customers are gradually entering the store. We know that the Lane Bryant killer got away with around $200 from the store's register, along with whatever money and jewelry the employees and customers had on them, which is not a whole lot, but people have been killed for a lot less. But that still doesn't explain why the gunman would remain at the scene for so long after he already robbed and subdued the victims. It seems apparent that the killer's breaking point was when he noticed that Rhoda McFarland had secretly used her cell phone and Bluetooth headset to call 911. But if this had not happened, how much longer would he have stayed there? Did he originally have another plan in mind? This is why there's always been speculation that the robbery was an act of misdirection intended to cover up the real motive for this crime. But before I talk any more about this case, I want to take a few moments to mention a surprising connection it has to another story which was once featured on The Trail Went Cold. Nearly 7 years ago, on Minisode number 13, I covered the unsolved disappearance of 20-year-old Brooke Henson, who vanished from Travelers Rest, South Carolina, on July the 4th, 1999. Sadly, Brooke has never been found, and the case is still unsolved, but her story would be thrust into the national spotlight years later, when investigators discovered that someone had used Brooke's name, date of birth, and social security number to enroll in classes at Columbia University in New York. This provided some fleeting hope that Brooke might still be alive, but when the authorities tracked her down and asked her to provide a DNA sample to prove her identity, the woman subsequently took off. It turned out she was actually a con artist named Esther Reed, who had a history of fraud and identity theft, and after seeing Brooke Henson's name on a missing persons website, she decided to steal her personal information to enroll in university and managed to rack up over $100,000 in student loans and credit card debt. Reed was subsequently placed on the Secret Service's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list and profiled on America's Most Wanted, but the Lane Bryant shooting indirectly paved the way for her being caught. On February the 3rd, 2008, the day after the crime took place, the authorities were still conducting a massive manhunt for the shooter and made it a point to run a check on every out-of-state license plate they saw in the area. They wound up coming across a vehicle with out-of-state plates in the parking lot of the Sleep Inn, a motel located only a few miles away from the Lane Bryant store. When the police went to the owner's room to question them, a woman answered the door who claimed that her name was Jennifer Myers, and even though she provided a piece of identification, it turned out to be fake. Well, after being taken in for interrogation, the woman finally confessed that she was Esther Reed, and she later pled guilty to multiple felonies and was sentenced to 51 months in federal prison. I hate to say that the Lane Bryant shooting had any silver linings to it, but if the crime had not taken place, it's unlikely that anyone would have checked Reed's license plate, and who knows how long she would have remained a wanted fugitive before she was caught. Anyway, let's get back to the shooting itself. I mentioned earlier that investigators looked into the backgrounds of all six victims, but found nothing to indicate that any of them would have been personally targeted by the gunman. Each of the victims hailed from a different location, and Jennifer Bishop lived in an entirely different state and had only traveled to Tinley Park because her husband was attending a work conference. I think you can pretty much rule out the possibility of any of the store's customers being targeted, because unless the shooter had been following any of them that morning, how could he have known they would be at that particular Lane Bryant outlet at that particular time? But is it possible that the gunman had a grudge against any of the employees working that day? Well, the survivor, known only as Martha, has always maintained that she did not know this guy and claimed that when he first arrived, he pretended to be a delivery man. He even chatted with Martha and Rhoda for a few minutes before he pulled out his gun, so it doesn't sound like Rhoda recognized him either. I previously mentioned that over 2 years before she got hired at Lane Bryant, Rhoda had been an associate pastor at a church in the town of Crest Hill called the Embassy Christian Center. The main reason Rhoda left this job is because she had a falling out with the church's founder and senior pastor, George Aja Jr., over issues related to financial mismanagement. Since she was on the board of directors and considered Aja to be her spiritual mentor, it was standard practice for Rhoda to co-sign her name on any of the church's mortgages. However, Aja decided to take out an $859,000 mortgage on the property without her knowledge. He then left Rhoda in charge of the Crest Hill Church while he relocated to Austin, Texas, with his family and members of his congregation in order to purchase land to build a new church. Indeed, there was so much turmoil taking place in Crest Hill during this time period that the church lost a ton of members, and their average attendance went down from around 1,000 to only 75. This prompted Rhoda to resign, and the Embassy Christian Center in Crest Hill wound up closing, while Aja and his congregation focused all of their efforts on Texas. The main reason the authorities looked into possible links between this situation and the shooting was because a former Embassy Christian Center member made a phone call only an hour before the shooting, and this call was routed through a cell tower near the Lane Bryant outlet in Tinley Park. It's never been publicly revealed who made this call or what the context might have been, but investigators found the link intriguing enough to travel to Texas to interview Aja and a number of other church members. For his part, Aja made a public statement denying that he or anyone from the church were involved in the crime, as he personally believed that Rhoda was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. This whole angle with the church was first reported by the media in August of 2008, but I haven't heard anything about it since then, so I can only assume that the investigation into this lead never went anywhere. Now, I will acknowledge that it's certainly a very interesting coincidence that a former member of Rhoda's church made a call in such close proximity to the Lane Bryant store a short time before she was killed, but the key word here is former. If this person had followed George Aja to Texas and just happened to travel to Tinley Park right before the shooting took place, that is a bit odd, but if they left the Embassy Christian Center before Aja relocated and was still living in Illinois at that time, then the call would not seem as unusual. It does sound like there were some shady things going on with Aja and his church, but Rhoda had not been affiliated with them for over 2 years and had seemingly moved on with her life. Even if Rhoda had knowledge of some financial misdeeds, would it really be worth orchestrating a murder-for-hire plot from a completely different state and sending someone to kill her at her workplace? It would be one thing if Rhoda's family and friends had reported that she was acting strangely prior to her murder and seemed like she wanted to contact the authorities about something, but I've heard nothing to indicate this is the case. And if Aja or his church had reason for wanting Rhoda dead, it doesn't seem logical that they would kill her at her workplace during business hours while there were other witnesses around. Yes, theoretically, if this was a professional hit, the church may have wanted to make the crime look like a robbery gone wrong in order to lead suspicion away from themselves, but why wouldn't the shooter just kill Rhoda right away? Why take her into the back room and hang around for nearly 40 minutes, giving Rhoda the opportunity to call 911? Well, I still don't discount the idea that there is more to this story than the crime being a simple robbery gone wrong. I just don't see how this whole church angle fits, and the fact that we haven't heard anything else about it for over 15 years suggests this is nothing more than a red herring. So now's a good time to talk about Martha, the survivor of this crime. Her identity has still not been made public after all these years, so we obviously know very little about her background. If there was anyone from Martha's personal life who might have had a motive to kill her, investigators have never said so. Now, this woman survived a traumatic ordeal, so I really hate to bring this theory up, but since it's frequently mentioned during online discussions about this case, I do have to address it. What if the crime was an inside job, and the reason Martha survived was because she was in cahoots with the shooter? Of course, law enforcement has never given off any indication that they believe Martha was involved in the crime, but I do acknowledge that the version of events of how this crime supposedly unfolded is based entirely on her account. We know that Rhoda was not originally scheduled to work at the store that morning, so one theory I've seen pushed forward is that since Martha was going to be working alone, she made arrangements to have someone she knew rob the store while she was there, and they would later split whatever he managed to steal. They may not have originally intended on harming anybody, but since Rhoda unexpectedly showed up that morning, this threw off the entire plan and led to everyone besides Martha being killed. One possible reason the suspect has never been found or identified is because Martha deliberately provided a false description of him to the police in order to throw off the investigation. Well, it goes without saying that I have a number of issues with this whole theory. For starters, the assumption that Martha was originally scheduled to be working alone that morning is not entirely accurate, as some new information was made public last year. In February of 2023, around the 15-year anniversary of the crime, a woman known only as Lori agreed to an interview in which she revealed that she was a former Lane Bryant employee who had originally been scheduled to work on the morning of the shooting, but was unable to do so because her son had surgery that day. Laura had a cousin named Laura who was also employed at the Lane Bryant, but even though she asked Laura if she could take her shift, Laura said no since she had a hair appointment. This is the reason why Rhoda wound up coming into the store that day, and as you can imagine, both Lori and Laura have always been haunted by the fact that they conceivably could have been murdered instead. The point is that if Rhoda had not shown up that morning, Lori would have worked her shift there instead, and there's no reason for Martha to have believed she'd be working alone. One of the most perplexing unanswered questions in this whole crime is why the perpetrator would decide to rob a Lane Bryant store, which mostly dealt in debit and credit card transactions and didn't have much cash on hand. While I'm not entirely sure if this was that particular store's procedure, anyone who has ever worked in retail will know that the most common practice for stores like this is to take each day's deposit to the bank after closing. So in other words, most businesses are not going to have a lot of cash on the premises right after opening on a Saturday morning. And as an employee, Martha would have known this, so why arrange for someone to rob the place when there was only a couple hundred dollars to be stolen? It's not like this was a bank, or Martha was working as a guard on an armored car or something, so I don't think this would have been worth her while. While the perpetrator did wind up getting some extra money and jewelry from the employees and customers during the robbery, there's no way to know in advance how many customers would be in the store, or if they would be carrying any valuables. Of course, the main reason I don't believe this was an inside job is because Martha received a bullet wound which grazed the side of her neck. There are documented cases of people self-inflicting gunshot wounds on themselves in order to make themselves look like victims and cover up the fact that they were personally involved in the crime. But are you really going to fire, or trust someone else to fire, a gunshot which grazes the side of your neck? That just seems incredibly risky, and there are so many things which can go wrong. I find it far more believable that Martha sustained that wound when the perpetrator fired a shot down at her and she just happened to turn her head at the very last second. Since it sounds like the gunman went into panic following Rhoda's 911 call and fled the store immediately after he fired the shots, I could see him not double-checking to make sure Martha was dead. So overall, I do not believe Martha was complicit in this crime, and I'm glad that her identity has still not been made public, not only to protect her from the killer, but also to protect her from a potential witch hunt from online sleuths who believe she's involved. All that being said, I can understand why people have kept thinking outside the box in this case, since the perpetrator's actions make so little sense. After stealing all the available money and valuables and restraining the victims in the back room, Why did he continue to remain at the store for a prolonged period of time? These actions ultimately cost the lives of two additional customers who entered the store after the gunman committed his initial robbery. I guess another possible theory is that he was disappointed with the rather low amount of money that was there, so he decided to keep accosting and robbing every person who came in and planned to keep doing this indefinitely until Rhoda called 911 and he had to flee. Learning that this other employee, Lori, did not work her scheduled shift that morning made me wonder if perhaps the gunman was specifically targeting her and he waited around for Lori to show up. But if that were the case, he probably would have asked Rhoda and Martha where she was, and I'm guessing that investigators never found anything in Lori's background to suggest the perpetrator was after her. I could also see him hanging around the store for a while if he wanted to rape the victims, but even though he fondled one of the women, things never went any further than that. However, if the suspect was an incredibly desperate drug addict who may have just picked out the Lane Bryant as a random location to rob because he needed some quick cash, then I suppose there's no point trying to apply standard logic to his actions. But then again, if he was that desperate, why go through the ruse of pretending to be a delivery man and chatting with the employees for the first few minutes he was there, rather than just going in with guns blazing? It's just rotten luck that this particular Lane Bryant store didn't have any security cameras, as it seems pretty ridiculous that an outlet for a major retail chain would not have these precautions in 2008. But that might be the reason he decided to rob this location and go through the delivery man ruse, as he could have spent those first few minutes scouting the place to see if he noticed any cameras. If he had seen some, perhaps this guy would have just left and gone elsewhere, but once he realized he would not be captured in any surveillance footage, he decided to pull out his gun and go through with the robbery. Of course, another reason why the gunman may have chosen an outlet at the Brookside Marketplace Shopping Center is because it was in such close proximity to Interstate 80. For all we know, the suspect was not from Tinley Park or the surrounding area and was just passing through, which might explain why no one has ever identified him. If he immediately got back on I-80 after fleeing the scene, he could have already been in an entirely different state by the time this investigation got heated up. However, there's still some uncertainty about whether this man had a getaway driver or if anyone else was involved in the crime. As you recall, a security camera at the Target store located a few hundred yards away managed to capture footage of a dark sedan and an SUV-type vehicle pulling up near the Lane Bryant outlet at 10:39 and 10:40 a.m. And these vehicles both happened to leave at 10:45, which is right after Rhoda made the 911 call and right before the first officer arrived at the scene. While the footage was not clear enough to show if the gunman climbed into either of these vehicles, the timing does seem like one hell of a coincidence. Now, if the suspect had accomplices, I'm not entirely sure why they would need to show up in two separate vehicles, so it's also possible that only one of them is connected to him, and the other was driven by a completely innocent bystander. Whatever the case, it doesn't seem practical to bring accomplices into a robbery in which the take will only be a few hundred dollars, unless robbery was not the real motive for the crime. If that was the intention, this was quite a poorly orchestrated plan, because it makes no sense for the suspect to show up at the store shortly after 10 a.m., and his getaway vehicle to not arrive until nearly 40 minutes later. But this could provide an explanation for why he hung around the store for so long, as he may have simply been waiting for his ride. As far as I can tell, I've never heard anything about Martha mentioning if the suspect had his own cell phone or attempted to make any calls during his time there, but if his getaway vehicle was incredibly late, that could be one of the reasons he became incredibly agitated, along with the fact that Connie Wolfolk attempted to fight back against him. Earlier in the episode, I played audio of the 911 call, which featured snippets of the killer's voice, and the only part I could really make out was him yelling, quote, "I'm losing it." It appears he said this right around the moment he noticed Rhoda making the call, and the audio is all the more chilling knowing that Rhoda and the other victims were shot only seconds later. So now we have to talk about another prominent theory which has been formulated in online discussions about this case. The possibility that Martha may have been mistaken about the shooter being a man. Could the shooter have actually been a woman, or possibly even a trans person? Now, it does not appear that law enforcement has ever wavered from their belief that the killer was male, so it's possible they may have additional evidence besides Martha's account, which confirms this. But some people believe that the 3D composite sketch of the suspect shows someone with feminine features, and that their voice on the 911 audio sounds more like a woman than a man. Personally, from what I've heard of the audio, the perpetrator sounds more like a man to me, but some females do have masculine voices. I could believe that Martha might be mistaken about this person's gender if she only interacted with them for a brief window of time, but this person flat out chatted with Rhoda and Martha for a few minutes when they first entered the store. I'm skeptical that Martha's account could be that off, but if this individual was a woman or a trans person, that could be yet another reason why they have not been found after all these years, as law enforcement has seemingly put all their focus on finding a male suspect who matched that description. Obviously, if the suspect left DNA behind at the scene, this could provide conclusive answers about whether they were male or female, but law enforcement has always been pretty vague about that aspect of the investigation, and have often said they will not comment on any specific evidence which was taken from the scene. I mentioned earlier that some sources state that DNA and fingerprints were collected, but since this was a store which was often frequented by people, could anyone be certain that this evidence belongs to the killer? If Connie got the suspect's blood under her fingernails when she fought back, then this would be an ideal source of DNA, but I'm still not certain if the authorities have this. I hearken back to the quote from Detective Ray Violetto in 2016, where he confirmed that evidence was sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab for examination, but one particular piece of evidence, quote-unquote, did not receive the results we hoped we would. This statement could be interpreted in numerous ways, as it could mean there was no usable DNA evidence, or the sample just wasn't large enough, but it could also mean that the DNA just didn't match anyone in the system. Remember, genetic genealogy did not become a tool in criminal investigations until 2018, so if the perpetrator had never been arrested, any DNA evidence entered into criminal databases would not yield any results. However, if they do have DNA, then I wonder if they have attempted to use genetic genealogy within the past few years. Whatever the case, unless law enforcement says otherwise, I'm going to continue operating under the assumption that the killer is male. I know that investigators have withheld a number of details, but if they did uncover conclusive evidence that the suspect was female, I have to think they would say so publicly and get the correct information out there, because otherwise, they can't expect to receive any useful tips. Given the brutal nature of these murders, it would surprise me if the perpetrator has never been arrested or served time in prison for another crime. Last year, a retired police commander expressed his belief that the suspect may have died at some point since 2008, because he cannot imagine being able to remain under the radar for so long after doing something so brazen. This is doubly true if the suspect was a drug addict or lived a high-risk lifestyle, but if he is still alive, he may currently be incarcerated for another crime, and investigators have just never put two and two together. Of course, genetic genealogy has made it possible to posthumously link crimes to deceased suspects, so that is still an option in this case if the killer is dead and there is DNA evidence available. I mentioned in the intro that of all the cases featured on The Trail Went Cold, which I'm most surprised are still unsolved, the Lane Bryant shooting ranks right near the top of the list. This is a crime with a surviving witness who provided a detailed description of the perpetrator, who did not appear to be a criminal mastermind, or behave in a logical, rational manner, so you had to think he would eventually do something which led to him getting caught. Yet somehow, in spite of the massive publicity surrounding this case from many media outlets and true crime podcasts, this individual has managed to elude the authorities for 16 years. Personally, I'm inclined to go with the simplest theory that this was an unsophisticated robbery gone wrong, and that even though the perpetrator's actions make very little sense, this could simply be due to the fact that he was a mentally unstable person. But a small part of me does wonder if he had another motive for this crime, and there's a lot more to this story. The only way we'll ever know for sure is if the suspect is caught, and if there's no DNA or forensic evidence, the only way his capture might be possible is if the right person comes forward. Since his composite sketch is out there on the internet for the whole world to see, perhaps this person will finally be recognized someday. But if you happen to have any information about the Lane Bryant shooting, please contact the Tinley Park Police Department tip line at 708-444-5394. That's 708-444-5394. Remember, there is still a $100,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the offender, which is not contingent upon a conviction. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. We also wanted to remind everyone that for the month of February, The Trail Went Cold will be teaming up with a nonprofit organization called Season of Justice, which raises money for the families of cold case victims by helping spread awareness and possibly funding DNA testing. If you would like to make a donation to Season of Justice, all the information about them is listed in our show notes and on our social media pages, but you can donate by visiting givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or texting TRAIL24 to 53555. That's givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail, or you can text TRAIL24 to 53555. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode about the 1981 murder of Rhonda Hinson, which is technically our podcast's very first edition of The Trail Revisited. I covered that story all the way back on episode number 4 nearly 8 years ago, but since I've learned a ton of new information in recent years, I decided to take a fresh look at the case and put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 1984 murder of Morris Davis. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has a lot of interesting discussions about today's featured case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or you can leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶